Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, June 26, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, as today we discuss the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Trinity Lutheran, the religious liberties case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel of the Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome as our guest today David A. Kortman. He was lead counsel in Trinity Lutheran Church of Columbia versus Pauli, and also senior counsel and vice president of U.S. litigation at Alliance Defending Freedom. He's going to give us opening remarks on the case, provide some background, talk about today's decision for about 15 or 20 minutes, but then, as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions. With that, the floor is yours, David A. Kortman.
Well, I just want to first thank you, Dean Reuter and FedSoc, for all that you guys do, the important work, and we certainly appreciate it. I think it's a good day for religious freedom, a great opinion from the court. First, what I'll do is I'll start with a little background on the case, how it arose, some of the facts, a short description of how the program worked, and then how that worked its way up to litigation, and then quickly how the lower courts ruled, and of course into the opinion today with a little bit of analysis on the various opinions that came out. The case was an interesting case, as you can imagine, when it first came to us and we heard about the facts that this was about kids playing on the playground and the fact that they were disqualified from receiving a government benefit because they chose to go to a religious preschool. We certainly thought those were great facts, and I think that ended up proving true throughout the case. And I think that was one of the things certainly gives what we would consider good atmospherics to a case when you have those type of good background facts. But what I think is important about the way this program was set up is the way that it was originally designed by the state of Missouri. Certain states throughout the country have these type of recycling programs. This specifically was passed several years ago, and it's for the purpose of cleaning up the state, its landfills, its rivers, its streams, of scrap tires. We know those are an environmental hazard and certainly a nuisance on many different levels. So the state, they began this fairly complex recycling program, and one part of the program was the ability to receive a partial reimbursement grant for recycled tires that were used for either running track surfaces or, in this case, for the surfaces of playgrounds. And the state opened up this specific part of the program to not-for-profit preschools and other not-for-profit entities, including government entities that had playgrounds attached to them. Everybody was permitted in those groups to apply. There was quite a complex application to submit with diagrams and several quotes from vendors and what the material was going to be used for. Also had over 16 different neutral criteria, and the government took in all these applications. It happened to be 44. The year that Trinity applied, and it graded them on a predetermined scale of how you satisfied these different neutral criteria. And what it did is it graded all these, and then the top certain number would receive a partial reimbursement grant depending on how much was in the fund. Now the fund, that basically was a 50 cent tax per tire on any tires purchased. And so that would go into this separate fund, and at the end of the year, that would be the amount that was put toward these reimbursement grants. There was a certain amount of maximum, I believe it was $20,000, that was allowed to be requested in each grant, and some would ask for less and some would ask for that amount. And so that determined the number of grants each year that would be permitted. In this particular case, it ended up where Trinity Lutheran not only did well in its scoring, it actually was ranked fifth added 44 different applicants based on these neutral criteria, and was slated to receive a grant as 14 grants were given. But then once the state realized, looking at the application, that the Child Learning Center preschool was actually owned and operated by Trinity Lutheran Church, it actually disqualified them from the program, even though it had already scored them high atop the rankings of everyone who submitted that. So they actually wrote them a little email and said, we apologize, realizing that you're actually owned and operated by a church. Our state establishment clause provision, some people call it a Blaine Amendment provision, as we did in the briefing, disqualifies you as we're not permitted to allow any direct or indirect aid to go to churches and, as they wrote in their brief, other religious organizations. So we were contacted by the preschool, and what was interesting about it is they, too, didn't quite understand that if they qualified for all other criteria given by the state, why they would be disqualified solely based on religious status. And so we filed the litigation in the district court, and thought it was a pretty good case, thought the facts were pretty clean, there wasn't a lot of discrepancies, everybody agreed and stipulated to all the facts. The question was, as a legal matter, would the state be allowed to disqualify the preschool solely because of its religious status, and could they rely on their state separation of church and state, their state establishment clause, their state Blaine Amendment. Interestingly, of course, Locke versus Davey, which was a previous case ruled on by the Supreme Court several years ago, was one of the main cases that was analyzed by both sides. And the pundits, of course, discussed it. Would this be the case that governs? Is it the same as Locke versus Davey? Is it different? We were unsuccessful at the district court, and the court basically ruled that Locke versus Davey discussed the play in the joints. Is there this room between what the Establishment Clause prohibits and what the Free Exercise Clause requires? That play in the joints, is that where this falls? Even if it didn't violate the Federal Establishment Clause, which the parties agreed to, could it still then violate the State Establishment Clause? And so the court basically ruled that it wasn't a violation, it wasn't required by the Free Exercise Clause or the Equal Protection Clause, and we had some other claims that we dropped as it went up. But the court said it wasn't required and there was no violation of the federal constitution. They were permitted to do so based on the play in the joints and Locke versus Davey. Went up to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, where we fared a little bit better. We lost but got one dissenting judge, Judge Groinder, and he basically ruled that this was a violation because it excluded based on religious status, and Locke versus Davey is not that expansive. We actually asked for a rehearing in that case, and it was a 5-5 tie, which was a little bit better, but a majority is needed for rehearing on bonk to be granted, and so it wasn't. It was taken up to the Supreme Court. Interestingly enough, the case was quite a roller coaster, as you could imagine. But shortly after cert was granted, Justice Scalia passed away. And so everybody was pontificating about, was there a split in the court? Would this be a 5-5 case? What would happen to it? And I think that was kind of fueled a little bit because the case sat over a year before argument was set from, I believe it was January of last year to April 19th of this year when it was argued. And so there was a lot of speculation, a lot of opinion swirling based on that time. And, of course, the election, no one knew, you know, who was going to win the election and then who would be appointed on the court to replace Justice Scalia's seat. And so, obviously, we didn't know what to expect. And as you all know, Justice Gorsuch was put on the court. So it was an interesting, evolution, the way the case worked, as many ups and downs and excitements and disappointments and, positive thinking, questionable thoughts, what's going to happen. So it was quite interesting as the case worked its way through the courts. And, of course, what also happens is the case gets distilled quite a bit. Issues get clarified, issues get dropped. Then, of course, the question has to be, what is something that the Supreme Court would be interested in this case. And of course, most cases bring 3, 4, 5 different claims, but that has to be narrowed to an issue the Supreme Court may be interested in. Then, of course, in the cert petition, you have to decide what is most likely to get the court's attention, and how do you brief that to bring it to the court as a way to say, look, there's some guidance needed here. Not only is this an important federal issue, but there's a conflict in the Court of Appeals, which is, as everyone knows, is one of the main reasons why the Supreme Court grants review in these cases. And so the idea is bringing up the cert petition with this whole question about Locke versus Davey. What does it stand for? How far does it reach? And there's many different law review articles and blogs and opinions that have been expressed over the years. Did the court limit it to that specific issue of is there a funding of a vocational funding of clergy? Was that the specific issue, or was it much broader to any historical establishment clause interest or any interest that could be deemed to not only not necessarily even to violate the establishment clause, but to raise establishment clause concerns? And so one of the interesting issues is the state was making the argument that even though they conceded it did not violate the federal establishment clause, that once it raises significant establishment clause concerns, that should be sufficient for it to fall in this gray area, this play in the joints area. And that brings its own issues and questions, is how big is that area? And even if there's, which is seemingly always raised by the state or the government, whoever the actor is, it always potentially raises establishment clause concerns. It seems to be the question is whether it actually violates the establishment clause. So one big issue was if it's sufficient to simply raise an establishment clause concern and that provides a compelling interest, then that seems to be, we would think, troublesome precedent that merely if the establishment clause is raised, that's sufficient in and of itself, not even to have a violation. And so that was one of the issues we were concerned about. And of course, the other one was, is how far does the free exercise clause go? Is it be retaining or attaining greater vitality? Is it coming back to being its own, being able to stand on its own 2 feet? For many years, as you all may know, the free speech clause has somewhat taken over in religious type cases where the free speech argument has been made and not necessarily the free exercise argument. But yet it's its own, obviously, clause. It should have its own provision. So what has Smith done? Is there a way to give some strength back to the free exercise clause? And so it has some independent meaning. So in drafting the cert petition, you're contemplating all these different issues. What appeals to the Supreme Court? What do they want to revisit at this time? Is it something too fresh? Is it something they don't want to touch? Obviously, what's the makeup of the court and who's going to be on it and how are they going to rule? And so there was really a lot going into this. I had thought originally that we should be able to garner more than if it even was a 5-4 vote, but even after we lost Justice Scalia, more than the bare majority. And the reason of that is reading through back precedent, I thought we would at least have Justice Breyer and Justice Kagan. But as the experts kind of opined and the court took so long to set it, it started thinking, well, you know, could this be a 4-4? Because why are they waiting so long? You know, if this is going to be a 6-2, why wouldn't they just set it? And so that kind of fueled the speculation as to what was going to happen. But again, we originally thought that this case should reach a greater number merely because of the court, we think, has stated several different times in several different cases that discriminating solely based on religious status or forcing an adherent to choose between the exercise of their religious beliefs and the receipt of a government benefit, that was enough of a punishment to violate the pre-exercise clause. If you go back and look at McDaniel versus Patey, which we relied upon, even in the Smith case, Lukumi, the unemployment cases, they all seem to have that same theme. And so one of our goals was not necessarily to invent something brand new for the court or a brand new test, but basically say, look, the facts of this case and legally the program here fits those same admonitions that you've given in past cases. And so we're not asking for a new rule. We're not asking, for example, for Locke versus Davy to be overturned. But consistent with all those cases, you can find that this was a free exercise violation and rule that way without having to create something completely new out of whole cloth. So in receiving the ruling today, it was interesting reading through the separate opinions, how the different justices joined, obviously the footnote 3, and which we'll talk about that. A few of the justices joined, a few of them didn't, and then Breyer's concurrence, which is more narrow, a couple of the concurrences that were a little more broad, and of course the dissent by Justice Sotomayor, joined by Justice Ginsburg. So just to begin with the majority, it was, I thought, a very strong language in the opinion about the inability of governments to be able to open up some sort of government benefit program and then say, not based on any neutral criteria are you disqualified, but even if you are qualified under all other bases, you can be disqualified solely because of your religious status. And it actually went through and discussed the cases that we briefed, Lukumi and McDaniel versus Patey, and all the cases that discussed those type of issues, and kind of went through each one of those. And I thought that was kind of important too, because it really tracked the way we briefed the case, the way we argued that this was status-based discrimination. It was kind of language that was used at the oral argument, which is always nice to hear when you're arguing and the justices are kind of using some of the arguments you've put before them. The other thing I think that was important was the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, or that unconstitutional choice. I was asked some questions in oral argument. Well, why is this a free exercise violation? The church is free to operate as a church. The preschool is free to operate as a preschool. It just doesn't receive the government benefit for the playground, but it still can operate the playground. It still can do whatever it wants to do. And one of the responses was yes, but it can't do both simultaneously. It can't both operate as a religious preschool and receive the government benefit, which this court has said in the unemployment cases that choosing between receiving some sort of government benefit and exercising your beliefs is unconstitutional coercion, even if it's in a minor sense of unemployment benefits, or in this case, the reimbursement grant. So it was good to see that. I think that language is helpful. It talked a little bit about the unconstitutional conditions doctrine. And so I think it addressed that head on, that it's not just a free exercise violation when there's an outright prohibition on free exercise, or a punishment for the exercise of your religion, for example, being jailed or fined or something like that. But yet this is the same type of violation if there's a choice between, like in McDaniel versus Patey, where the minister there was not allowed both to be a minister and to be a constitutional delegate. He couldn't do both simultaneously, and the court said that's a violation of his free exercise rights because he was not allowed to do both simultaneously. So there were several concurrences, one by Justice Thomas basically questioning Locke, whether that's even viable, Justice Gorsuch going a little bit further and saying that this shouldn't be limited to just status-based discrimination, but also to religious uses, because there's really no principled line between the two. Justice Breyer tried to narrow the case just to the health and safety issues by his concurring opinion. And then, of course, a strong dissent by Justice Sotomayor, who basically said, the way I read it, is that any funding to churches is a sufficiently compelling Establishment Clause interest not to permit it, whether it's in the play in the joints or whether it's outright prohibited, that this shouldn't be allowed in any form or fashion. So that's a kind of opening regarding the background of the case and some cliff notes on the opinion itself. So if Dean, you wanted to jump in.
Thank you so much. Let's go right to the audience for their questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got plenty of time for questions. Our lines are wide open. Let me get things started while we wait to see who rings in. I'm interested about footnote number 3, how it got into John Roberts' opinion, and whether it ties in at all to your comments about the delay in a decision coming out in this case. I know there was a lot of concern or a lot of thinking that it might be a 4-4 or a 5-3. That was the reason for the delay. Does footnote 3 tie into that in any way? And independent of that, what do you make of footnote 3?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it does. It probably does have something to do with it. The court maybe not being 100% sure of who would vote how and how broad or narrow the opinion is. So I think you're right on that front. What was interesting when I read it, I was kind of deciding, you know, what does this mean and why was it necessary? And I think Justice Gorsuch's concurring opinion really has the best explanation for it. And he basically said in so many words, look, I agree that footnote 3 is accurate for what it says. My concern is it's going to be read much more broadly and being taken to mean other things that it doesn't. And so I think that's the right explanation. And so the few justices that didn't agree to join, I don't think it was so much that they didn't agree with it, but I think they were concerned about the abuse of it. And I think that's a good comparison to Locke versus Davey, for example. One of the fears, and several people have written law review articles about it, is how far does it really go? Even though the court limited it to that historical established clause interest of direct funding to the training of clergy, would that be then taken and expanded to other issues? And the answer is yes. So the lower courts expanded Locke, we believe, way beyond what the court said. And what was interesting is this was one of the reasons we brought this case and, in fact, asked the court to rule on that, because Locke was taken, I think, further than it should have. And so I think the justices who didn't agree with that were more worried about the mischief from it. And my guess is we will see some of that mischief as time goes on. The way I read it is as you read it on its face, I think it's right. This case involves express discrimination based on religious identity with respect to playground resurfacing. There's nothing remarkable about that statement. That's exactly true. We do not address religious uses of funding, which is true. This case was not about if I take money from the government and put it toward a religious use. It was specifically not about that. So that saves that case for another day. So that's true. Or other forms of discrimination that's not specifically religious status discrimination. So in and of itself, that's true. So what's interesting, on one level, when you read the footnote, it's unremarkable. But again, I think the right concern of those justices who didn't join was what will people say and try to inflate that to try to limit the scope of the opinion.
How often, you follow the court more generally, I'm sure, does the opinion's author, in this case Chief Justice Roberts, not join a part of the opinion he's authored? In this case, I think he did not join footnote 3, which was part of his majority opinion.
Yeah, I think that's right. And to your answer, not very often. In fact, when I first was reading through figuring out who joined what, which is sometimes very interesting dynamics, you know, jotting myself notes and marking who joined what. But that is something that is odd, to say, look, I've drafted this whole opinion, but not this one footnote, but allowing that footnote to be attached in the opinion, as opposed to saying, well, you could draft your own concurrence on it, and maybe making more of a big deal than it was, and that would have changed dynamics a little bit. So it is an interesting factor, and looking at those who joined it and those who didn't. So he allows it to come in and then doesn't join it. So it is something that does not happen very often, but I think lately we see things from the court that are new. So everybody who practices here thinks, you know, they prognosticate about what's going to happen. The more I work with the court, the more I realize how little I know. And things continue to surprise me about what happens.
Once again, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We'll start with 3 questions. Let's take our first call.
David, this is Paul Strang.
Go right ahead. We can hear you.
Yes. I am wondering, what was your general feeling today as you got the ruling, and do you think that this has wide national implications?
The feeling generally was great. It was better the more that I read it, and I think it does. And I think that was one of the big issues. How narrow would the opinion be? How broad would it be? We specifically brought the challenge as applied and not as a facial attack on the Blaine Amendment. Most people are aware they're in, depending on how you count and use the different types of terminology, but there's about 39 states that have similar types of language. Would that be too much for the court to attack them facially? So in that sense, it's an as-applied ruling, but not facially. But there's really a giant caveat to that is, and that is, the way I read the principle is that even though this is an as-applied challenge, the court made it pretty clear that whether it's based on a Blaine Amendment or not, that I think the government has a hard time to say if you otherwise qualify for this government program under secular and neutral criteria, if the only reason we exclude you is based on your religious status or religious identity, that's not going to fly anymore. And so I think that the implications of the case are extremely broad, probably much more broad than people expected. And one way to tell that is to read the dissent. One thing I've learned long ago is you may have a majority that may try to play things down, not to make it as big of a deal. But if you really want to see what's going on, the dissent comes out and says, look, here's what's going on, regardless of which side is writing it. You could remember some of Justice Scalia's dissents that would just blow the doors off the opinion and say, look, here's what's going on, even though the majority would try to downplay it. Well, if you read the dissent here, you come away with that conclusion. Some of the language that's used in the dissent I thought was quite incredible. Justice Sotomayor says, the constitutional provisions of 39 states all but invalidated today. The weighty interests they protect and the history they draw and deserve more than just judicial brush aside. So you can tell that a few members of the court realize the gravity and the breadth of this decision, and I think that will prove to be true because there are governmental programs across the country that have these type of prohibitions that I don't think will be able to stand anymore.
In that regard, this is Dean Reuter. Is there a next big case that our callers should be paying attention to headed for the Supreme Court, maybe even already on the docket in the fall?
Well, it'll be interesting to see where this case is applied. As you may know, the court granted the Masterpiece case today, which is it's a different type of issues, but it's going to also test the limits of the Free Exercise Clause and what it protects. And so there's for those of you who are not familiar with it, very quickly, it's basically we've heard about the conscience cases, the florist, the baker, the photographer, the fire chief, and all these folks who are being forced to violate their beliefs and their rights of conscience to run their businesses or make a livelihood. In this particular case, Jack Phillips of Masterpiece Bakery serves everybody, serves the LGBT community, makes cakes for all different types of events, and in this case, politely refused to celebrate a same-sex wedding ceremony with a rainbow-themed cake, was found to have violated the law in Colorado. And so that's going to be another big case in the fall that kind of determines whether it's under two theories there that we asked both about the this is compelled speech and about the free exercise rights behind it. And so I think that's going to be a pretty good case and a big case, depending on if the court goes the speech route or the free exercise route, to determine what the free exercise clause means, what happens if it butts against other rights and other theories. And so I think that's going to be a big one. As far as Trinity specifically, I don't know yet of any. I'll be interested to see what happens with the pending case of Douglas County that's been sitting at the court, and so we'll see what kind of effect that has afterwards.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've still got three callers with questions pending. Let's take another call.
Hi, this is Will Trackman, General Counsel of Douglas County Schools. I wanted to get your opinion on the Sotomayor dissent, where she says the 39 states that have Blaine Amendments, those provisions are all but invalidated today, and whether she will come to regret that language. And then also I had one maybe clarifying question about footnote 3, which is I thought that Roberts was delivering it, that he was joining it, but that it wasn't for the court because there are only four justices for that footnote 3. Maybe I read it wrong. That's where I thought that language was coming from. But thank you so much for your teleform today.
Yeah, it's. Let me. I'll start with the last one on the footnote 3. I mean, that's one of the questions is who joined it. I took it to read that he did not, but I'm actually looking through Justice Lou. Kennedy, Alito, and Kagan joined that opinion in full. Thomas, of course, is except as to footnote 3. You know, it's a good question. I don't know. I was thinking that he did not join it. The terminology. But we'll see if there's any clarification that's given to that. But I think, you know, what's interesting is when I look back on Justice Sotomayor's dissent, and it, as I mentioned, it makes me think of sometimes, you know, the things that Justice Scalia would say. And whether he came to regret those or not, the question I thought of is will they prove to be true? Will they be right? And often enough, when Justice Scalia would say, hey, here's what's really going on, this is what's going to happen, it often did. And so I would look at it and say, is what she said a truism, or will it become to be true? And I think, you know, and I don't want to over-exaggerate it, but I think in large part it will. And what I mean by that is, as you all may know, and you certainly may know, out of all the states that have these more restrictive provisions, not all of them interpret it in such a restrictive way. And so there are states that have these quote-unquote Blaine amendments that say, well, we're still going to allow religious organizations to participate or religious schools to participate in the voucher programs. It's almost where they choose not to, or the state Supreme Court says that they cannot and they have to exclude them. So hopefully this case will go a long way in saying, first of all, and I did a debate with the gentleman that argued the other side, Jim Layton, and what he said was, well, you know, what are we going to do now? And my response was, well, you should do what the other states do and treat everybody equally. So I don't know why, if the Supreme Court has said there's really no a valid reason to treat them differently, and in fact you cannot, then why would a state want to say, we don't want to allow all schools, you know, both government and private and both, you know, religious and secular. Why wouldn't we allow all schools to participate in these types of programs? If it benefits the kids, it helps education. Obviously, it gives more school choice. And we're allowed to do so, and we may even be required to do so. Why wouldn't we? And that really was my response to him. You know, there seems to be now no good reason not to. And so my hope is that it does play out to be accurate in her opinion, because I don't think there really is a good reason to do so when you're opening those programs, because they really are for the benefit of the kids anyway. So I appreciate that question.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button. Two questions on the board remain. Let's take another call.
Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go right ahead, caller.
Thank you. I have two questions for the speaker, and thank you very much for your presentation today. First, I take it that Justice Sotomayor would have dissented in Everson from the tone of her dissent as you've described it, and the fact that Justice Breyer was willing to concur narrowly on health and safety along with Justice Kagan. And I was wondering if you could confirm that sense that I have. The other is whether there was any attention in any opinion, including the Chief Justice's, on the fact that this was a grant and aid program that Missouri had established with some discretion. I understand that it was the criteria were objective, but still they were there, as opposed to a strict voucher or a per capita program. You may recall from Mitchell versus Helms, that was material to Justice Breyer anyway. And yet, I'm not sure I've heard anyone say that it mattered this time around. So if you could address that, I'd be grateful. Thank you.
Sure. It's for the first question, you're probably right. It seemed when I read Justice Sotomayor's dissent, what's interesting is Everson is attributed to the terrible language and the terrible test that some of us believe in the Establishment Clause. But yet it went the right way in the ruling. It just had a lot of caveats and problems in getting there, but yet upheld, you know, both the Everson and the Allen cases with the busing in the books. which I talked a little bit at in the argument. But I think so. It seemed to be that what I took her dissent to say, that if you're truly a religious organization and you're serious about your faith, then absolutely right, period, no benefits like this, because otherwise it's helping you advance your religious mission. Just like here on the playground, it seemed to be that she would want, in fact, she said in, I think, a footnote, that council wouldn't concede that the playground would never be used for anything religious. Well, not only wouldn't I concede that, but I actually pushed back against that in the argument. And the argument I made was, it seems to me that that's going too far. And what I said was, so if there's a, for example, the busing and the books that were upheld in Everson and Allen, could the state then say, because we're giving you this separate benefit of the busing for the children and the secular textbooks, once you receive that, could we then turn around and make a condition that says, now that you're using those books in your school, you could no longer teach about, you know, teach religion in your schools? In other words, that unconstitutional benefit and that unconstitutional condition, and it goes too far. But yet I think she would require that in reading, for example, Mitchell in the dissent there, to say that not only can you not use anything for religion, but even if there's a possibility of what it called diversion and use for religion, you couldn't use it. And even Justice Breyer didn't go that far. And in fact, the plurality in the Mitchell case specifically held it doesn't matter. If it's this neutral program and it goes to everybody on an equal basis, if there is some use of the money for religion, it's being advanced incidentally by the private party, not by the government. So I think you're probably right in how she would have come out in Everson, unless she could say, well, it's not really religious, or they don't take their faith seriously, or they don't require it, or they don't teach it, or anything like that, which is in part what Missouri does. It allows some of this type of funding if you have an independent board, if you don't require religious classes or chapel attendance. So if you're marginally religious, it's okay, but if you're serious about your faith, it's not. As to the second question, I'm not sure how much that did play a part here, as far as you're talking about the difference in the aid and the discretion, and also the per capita, the way it broke up in Mitchell versus Helms. I don't really think that played a part in this, and the reason I don't think so is, I think this is a step higher than that. And what I mean by that is maybe more of the 50,000 foot level. In other words, we don't even have to get to that level yet about the particulars. But if we start off by saying, here's a program, by the way, that the state gets to decide how it's formatted. And that was one of my arguments here. The state could have done a lot of different things. It could have said, first of all, we're only going to use this for government-run organizations. There would have been no question here. Or we're only going to do it for playgrounds, you know, at a certain level or certain location, whatever it happens to be. But once it opened this up to not only all not-for-profits, but specifically not-for-profit preschools, and it sets out all these different criteria, then the question is can it say solely, not because of any other reason, but even though you meet all these criteria and meet them better than most other people, solely because of religious status, that violates the free exercise clause, the rest of these other questions, I think, fall under that. So we don't even need to get there, because at this high level, right there, you can't do it. There may be some other things you can do, but right at that height, it violates a free exercise, because there's no good reason. And on a more practical level, and this may be on whether there's a fit there, it's interesting that the government determines here that Trinity advanced this interest better than all but four different applicants. But yet, because it's religious, it chose someone who advanced those interests even to a lesser degree just because they're religious. That doesn't even make any common sense, never mind fit the compelling interest test.
All right. Thank you.
We've got one question pending, then our lines will be wide open. Oops, looks like we lost that question. If you have a question, you need to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We do have one question pending. Let's take another call.
Yes, hi. It's Laura Peterson. Forgive my cold. I hope you can hear me.
And we can hear you fine. Go right ahead.
Thanks so much. I haven't had a chance yet to read the opinion, but I thank you for the excellent presentation and wonder if you could kindly clarify the extent to which this is both a free exercise and an establishment clause case, and if it were both, would you clarify where the contours of the one clause begin and the other might end?
It's a great question. If I could only do so, I think I can explain where I think it is. But so on the first question, as far as is this both a free exercise clause case and an establishment clause case? So I would say I kind of have two answers. I'll give you my lawyer answer. I would say yes and no, and here's what I mean by that. Technically speaking, it only deals with the federal establishment clause. I'll talk about the state establishment clause in a minute. So as far as on the federal level, it's technically only a free exercise clause case on the federal level, mainly because both parties conceded or agreed that it would not violate the federal establishment clause for these benefits. So on that sense, it really wasn't as if the other party argued it would violate the federal establishment clause. But the reason I kind of caveat that a little bit is it certainly plays in the opinion. And if you read the dissent, the federal establishment clause is raised and discussed very much so. And the fact that this is and would be a violation of that clause. So I don't want to completely say it has nothing to do with the federal establishment clause, because even though it was conceded by the parties, the dissent says we don't go by concessions, we go by what the law is. And at least those two thought this would violate the federal establishment clause. So I think there is some discussion about its application. I think that'll be used in the future, both how that plays into the mix. Certainly does bring in the state establishment clause question with the Blaine Amendments and the 39 states that have them in a big way. And I think that's because I think the court held clearly enough that if that's the way states are going to interpret their establishment clauses, they're going to have a hard time doing that in the future, regardless of the type of program. And I think that's the important takeaway here.
We've still got about 20 minutes left, 15, 20 minutes. If anyone has a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. I want to, if I could, return to the Sotomayor dissent. You mentioned the health and safety exception. Does her dissent go far enough that she would discount that and deny Trinity Lutheran some of the public health and safety measures that are common to all citizens and entities in the community?
It's an interesting question. I think if Justice Breyer would have had his way, that would have been the way the opinion would have came out, and very narrow, just health and safety. But even in health and safety, it would still be somewhat broad, because especially these days, there's many, many programs that do specifically apply to that, especially this day and age with all the threats we have, both domestically and foreign. But I think in her opinion, and here's what's interesting, and I'll analyze this compared to what the state argued. So we were making the argument about how far this goes, and what's the principal difference between this, for example, and general benefit of police and fire protection. And some people would say, well, that's not a legitimate comparison. But here's why I think it is. First of all, the state constitution says any direct or indirect aid, and it's certainly indirect aid at a minimum to provide police and fire protection to religious organizations. And what was interesting, what the state responded in its brief was, no, not that we're legally required to allow that. What it said was, yeah, that's similar to what we're doing here, but we would never do that. Well, that's not the type of insurance you want as a principle in the law, because according to their argument, they could make the same exact argument and say, it costs us additional money, we have to hire new people, we have to buy new equipment, we have to do all these things for police and fire protection, that's indirect aid. Legally speaking, under our Constitution, we can prohibit that and should prohibit that. And the reason I bring that up, it's kind of how it seems in Justice Sotomayor's dissent, where straight on principle, you would have to come to the same conclusion that they would be allowed to do so. Another example would be, what if here the state said, we're going to purchase all the scrap tire after it's been recycled, and we're going to leave it at our facility. And not-for-profits can come with a truck, pick it all up, and place it down at your own expense. That still would have been prohibited by the Missouri Constitution, yet there would have been no direct outlay of funds from the state to the church, which is one thing that they were claiming was a violation. But even that indirect provision would have been a violation of their state establishment clause. So when you take that back to Justice Sotomayor, on principle, if you're aiding or benefiting a religious organization or a church, for example, one argument is well, even if it's not direct money, we're freeing up other money for them to do other religious things. That argument has been brought up in the past by dissents all throughout Everson and all those cases forward, and the majority of the court has always rejected that, that whole money is fungible and it frees up other money as a reason not to disallow it, because that's always the case. No matter what public benefits you give to anyone, secular or religious, it's always going to free up other money. And as a little side note, in this particular case, it actually cost the Trinity Lutheran more than it received. So they actually ended up in the negative because this was only a partial reimbursement grant. So if they were going to go through with this, which they otherwise couldn't afford, what would end up happening is they would be out of pocket at least $10,000, not ahead of the game by $20,000. So I think her dissent would probably go so far if it was principled, because I don't know what the principle line is when you have direct or indirect aid to say we can give you, we won't give you directly cash, but we'll buy something and then give that something to you. So I think it would follow the same line as the state's argument did.
We've got one question pending, then our lines will be wide open. Push the star button and the pound button on your phone if you'd like to join the conversation. Let me just follow up really quickly, I think somewhat along this line, if I could. We had a telephone earlier today on President Trump's executive order on the immigration moratorium. There was a lot of discussion in those cases about the president's animus in signing that executive order. With regard to the Blaine amendments, I'm interested in what you see as their future. And with regard to the executive order, a lot of folks are pushing back against the use of statements made by the president in the campaign and otherwise in terms of determining his motivations in signing the executive order. But by the same token, the Blaine amendments historically have been analyzed as having an anti-Catholic sentiment. When can you and can you not consider sort of the animating motives of the enacting body?
Yeah, that's a great question, and the court has wrestled with that for decades and decades with various opinions by the different justices about whether you should or whether you shouldn't. My take on that is whatever the court does, it should be consistent. And so what I mean by that is, I think it's an argument that's inconsistent to say, for example, we don't want to look at the animus, anti-Catholic animus that's in the Blaine amendments here. In fact, they came up briefly at the oral argument and in the case. Now, we briefed that this was a Blaine amendment and it did have the animus, but we didn't want to have the case, the only way to win is by striking them down, because we thought its current application was sufficient. But our belief is, as many others, that this is a Blaine Amendment. It was enacted the same exact year with the same exact language. The previous language of the Constitution was changed to be stricter. There's a lot of historical articles and things of that nature. But I guess my point is, if you're going to say animus matters, then you need to be consistent in saying it always matters. So if it matters with President Trump's statements, it should matter with the Blaine Amendments. And if it shouldn't matter, one shouldn't matter the other. So the consistency, I think, is one thing. The other thing, I think and this is just my opinion personally, I think it's troublesome to try to attribute animus to striking of something down through presidents and secretaries of state and those type of officials, because if you want to go back and look at for example things President Trump said about the faith community during the HHS debates, or Secretary Clinton said, there's a lot of animus-based statements there, and do we strike down all those things because of those type of statements? I think it just gets you into a sticky thicket if you go into those things, and what are the subjective motivations, and what do they mean by that? And this is a Muslim ban, but yet all Muslims are not banned. It's only specific countries where there's been some threats, and all Muslims from everywhere else can come, including entire countries. So I just think it's troublesome and certain justices have said this, when you try to get into the minds of politicians and legislatures as to what they were thinking, as opposed to just analyzing the end product under a legal or constitutional analysis, which I think is the better way to go.
We do have time for more questions from the audience. One question pending. Push the star button, then the pound button if you'd like to ask a question for now. Let's take another call.
Hello. I asked a question earlier. I'd like to follow up on that. I'm going to propose something as a back-of-the-envelope summary of this case, and you let me know how this is an oversimplification. The state of Missouri made an explicit distinction on the basis of religion, which under free exercise provokes strict scrutiny. The state can't say, well, we have to discriminate against you to avoid establishing religion, because they've conceded that that's not on the table. Therefore, strict scrutiny applies and they don't have a compelling public interest, and so they lose. Then you bring in Locke versus Davey. Locke versus Davey, by that argument, is wrong. But the court, instead of overruling Locke versus Davey, simply says we're going to limit it to its facts, and it only applies for direct funding for training for the ministry. Is that a fair summary, a fair elevator speech summary of the case?
I think it is. And I think what's interesting is on the Establishment Clause note, it was interesting that the state both conceded that it didn't violate the Federal Establishment Clause, but yet under the State Establishment Clause, that was sufficient enough of an issue in and of itself to override what would have been the Free Exercise Clause violation. The other thing they did was, in trying to avoid the Free Exercise violation, threw it back into Locke and saying, well, it's not a Free Exercise violation because it falls within that play in the joints. So it's interesting to see how they maneuvered between the Federal Establishment Clause, State Establishment Clause, and then Locke versus Davey to avoid the actual Free Exercise violation and try to fit it within play in the joints. But I think overall what you said was fairly accurate.
Okay, thanks.
We do have another question on the board now, so let's take another call.
I was curious about any implications you see in this case for the masterpiece cake case that the court accepted cert on. I understand that's a different context, but are there things that we can see from this case that might predict the outcome of that case?
I think there is some overlap. I'd like to predict the outcome as a win, but I'll just do that for my own benefit. There's some free exercise implications here. Let's remove the compelled speech question for a minute because of the overlap with this case that doesn't have. But on the free exercise front, I think there is some overlap. And when I was reading it, it was a good question. I was thinking of that today. And one of the things I was thinking about was that whole implication of can I be penalized somehow for living or operating according to my faith. And so what I was talking about earlier was this: can you be disqualified from this government benefit for exercising your faith? Well, just substitute that with can you be penalized in some way for exercising your religious freedom? And so I think there is some overlap there, because what happens is that it's just a different kind of penalty. So someone says, well, I want you to celebrate this religious ceremony with me, and you say, no, that violates my religious beliefs. Should the government then step in and punish that person because it violates their conscience? And I think the answer is not. Wherever you fall on the issue of marriage, I think everyone would still not want to be not only compelled to speak in a way that they don't want to support the message, but compelled to act in a way that violates their conscience. And so I think there is some overlap, and I'll be interested to see how that fits into the case as we go forward.
Thank you.
We have still one more question. Let's take another call.
Hi. The court seems to be saying that the state may not reward or penalize religious status, but must review according to neutral criteria. But what if the religious status is relevant to that neutral criteria? I'm thinking in particular of, let's say, anti-terrorism measures that give funding to institutions at risk for terrorism, and it may be that a synagogue or a mosque is at greater risk than a public school or a secular institution. How may the state consider that religious status in its evaluation of risk?
I don't think so, and I didn't read the court's opinion that way. In fact, it's a good question. I was asked that in the oral argument, and the question goes something like, if it's more like an equal protection argument. Well, if you can't consider religious status for a detriment, then you certainly can't consider it for a benefit. But the reason I don't think that's accurate is that the easiest way for me to explain it is that, for example, equal protection provides a floor. In other words, you can't treat religious groups or religious people worse than everybody else. But then you also throw in the protections of the Free Exercise Clause, which the Supreme Court has said many, many times that we may and sometimes must accommodate religion, and that we don't have to have that package to secular organizations or have secular benefits. So there's multiple clauses coming in here. So the point of it is I think you can both take religious status into account when you're talking about these types of issues or laws. So if it's a detriment, it has nothing to do with it. And in this case is a great example. Why would it matter if you are having the safety of children on a playground? Why would it matter who runs the school, right? It really has nothing to do with it. But if you're talking about defending local not-for-profits from attacks, and for example, it has to be, you know, you have this neutral government program, and the only question is, you know, who should we do first? Say we have one crew that goes and as Justice Alito kind of asked, and firms up the area around the building. And we know there's an imminent attack on a synagogue. Would the Establishment Clause prohibit the government from going there and doing that one first before it goes to a different one where the threat's not imminent? I don't think so. I think it would be permitted to do so. I think it would be allowed to under the Court's Establishment Clause and Free Exercise Clause precedents, and I think it would be able to do so under this case also.
Well, David Cortman, it looks like we're out of questions, but we're also just about out of time. Let me give you a minute or two to wrap up or express a final thought.
Well, again, I appreciate you hosting this and all that you do for us. It's a great forum, and you all do great work. I think this is one of those cases where we're going to see it play out for quite a while to come. There's going to be a lot of issues that's been mentioned on the call that will be litigated from this. I think what the court really did well, though, which sometimes it doesn't do, I think it was pretty clear in what it ruled upon and what governments cannot do. And I think any government that's looking for sufficient guidance, especially when sometimes we criticize the court for not being as clear as it could be, this opinion is a pretty clear roadmap of how to deal with these type of programs, regardless of what they extend to. And that is, if you lay them out on a neutral basis, you're not only under safe haven to include religious organizations along with everybody else, but you're likely required to. And I think that's a pretty good statement. I think it's a win for the First Amendment, for free exercise, and I think for people of faith across the board.
Well, my thanks to David Cortman for joining us today. This has been certainly educational for all of us. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder to check the Federalist Society's website, monitor your emails for the next scheduled teleforum conference call. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.